Good morning. And happy Mother's Day to all the mothers here, including maybe my own who might listen to this. Just to clarify, so about my studies so that we can all be on the same page. I'll be leaving here, I'm planning to leave here at the end of June and go to Germany for about a month, maybe more, depending on what happens. I might return in the spring, but there's no guarantee, and then I'm hoping to graduate either next summer or next fall. So about a year, year and a half, which in the whole scope of things is coming right up. So I wanted to talk today about one famous mother in the Bible, Ruth. And I'm going to intertwine the story of Ruth with another theme that runs throughout the book and throughout the life of Ruth, which is the idea of being a sojourner, or being a pilgrim, or being a wanderer. In one message I was listening to and preparing for this, the preacher said, this is in Arizona, and he said, despite the fact that Pilgrim's Progress is, you know, the best-selling book, Christian book after the Bible, maybe even the best-selling book, I don't know, of all time after the Bible, I'm not sure about that, but despite the fact that it's an extremely well-selling book, and everyone here has probably heard of it, seen a movie, or read parts, if not all of it, very few messages, in fact, today, at least in the West, focus on the Christian life as a pilgrim life. And it is kind of an interesting juxtaposition between, you know, how important it was, at least at the time that John Bunyan was writing, and maybe the frequency in which we think about it right now. So I think the story of Ruth is really interesting, not only for its really sort of moving composition and the elements in the story itself, but also for the fact that it can tell us something about being strangers in a world in which we don't belong. So Spencer began today reading parts of Ruth chapter 1. So in the first part, chapter 1, verses 1 to 7, we learn about being a famine in the land of Judah, and that Naomi and her husband and her two sons left the land of Judah to go to Moab. Now, Moab is on the other side of the Dead Sea from Judah, so it was not part of the land promised to the Israelites after crossing the Jordan. Rather, on the other side of the Dead Sea and on the other side of the Jordan. So they would have had to cross over maybe the Jordan to get to Moab, and there lived because of the famine. Then in the course of events, it doesn't say how, but Ruth's husband dies, as well as her two sons. They all die, and she says, you know, what do I have left in this land of Moab? I'm going to go return to Judah. The famine has ended. And in the time that they spent in Moab, Ruth's two sons married Moabite women. One was named Orpah, the other one was named Ruth. So when Naomi decides to go back to Judah, and this is at the end of the reading that Spencer was reading, when she decides to go back to Judah, initially it seems that both Orpah and Ruth are considering going along with her. But being Moabite women, Naomi says, you know, you guys should just stay in Moab. You know, you won't necessarily be welcome in Judah. There's, you know, tension between the Israelites and the Moabites. And now that your husband's gone, you're free to, say, remarry a Moabite man and start a family back in your homeland. But Orpah decides to remain in Moab, but her sister-in-law, Ruth, decides to stay with her mother-in-law, Naomi. So it says, Ruth said, and this is verse 16 of chapter 1, says to Naomi, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." Let's continue reading then in chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, and then 8 to 13. So you probably, most of us are familiar at least with some parts of the story of Ruth, but I think it's good to read over some of the key sections. So in Ruth chapter 2, verses 1, it says, "Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out, that is, Ruth set out, and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And let's skip down to verse 8. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go and glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she, Ruth, said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And let's skip back down to Ruth chapter 4 and verse 9. We'll read from verse 9 to 17. Then Boaz said to the elders, so basically what happens in the meantime, Ruth keeps working in the field of Boaz, careful to remain in his field, not in the fields of other landowners in the area. And then eventually she goes and there's this curious incident where she finds him sleeping and then lies down at his feet and she says, basically, "You need to be my redeemer." So we're going to read a section here where it describes the process of Boaz redeeming Ruth, and I'm going to explain a little bit later what it means to be a redeemer in this context. So verse 9, Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought the land, or bought from the hand of Naomi, all that belonged to Elimelech, and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the deed in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers, and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be known in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tabor bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So we see here this story, sort of like a love story, a romance here occurring, in which the beginning, Naomi and her husband, they leave the land of Judah for the sake of a famine. They go to Moab. There they begin to establish a family. Her two sons get married, but then disaster happens. And of course, it's not clear exactly how it happened, but the three men in the family died, and Naomi decides to return to Judah. So that's the kind of the low point in the story, the idea of Naomi saying, "Call me Mara because I'm no longer happy, I'm now bitter." And she returns to Judah, Ruth goes with her, and then it almost seems like they're going to have to start from scratch. They don't maybe have much property, it's unclear if they have any property, and you know, how are they going to continue on the line of Elimelech and Naomi in the absence of any male heirs. But Ruth nevertheless decides to work in the fields, and so she joins Boaz's workers and works there behind the servants who are working in the field, and then eventually realizes that he can be a redeemer. They then marry, and then they have a son. And this son, as we see in verse 17, becomes the father of Jesse, who is in turn the father of David. So this is the great-grandfather, or the grandfather of David, is born to Ruth. So Ruth is David's great-grandmother. And so this is an interesting element because we have a Moabite woman, not an Israelite, as Fred mentioned this morning, who then becomes one of the ancestors of not only David, but the Lord. So as I said earlier on, today being Mother's Day, there's two themes in this that I want to point out. One is the fact that Ruth is the ancestor, maternal ancestor of David. The other one is that Ruth, not being an Israelite, but a Moabite, symbolizes to us the idea of sojourning in a land to which we don't belong. Now you might think, okay, well, they were Moabites, they live nearby Israel, what's the big deal, right? You know, you could say, well, I'm a Canadian, I'm living in the United States, it's not that big a deal, right? But for us, you know, being a Canadian, living in the United States, being an American, living in Canada, there really isn't that much animosity between the two nations, such that and there aren't, you know, enough cultural differences to really make it extremely apparent that you might be a foreigner living in a foreign land. In fact, many times people are surprised when I tell them I'm an international student because they think that I'm an American. But in this case, it's a little bit different because the tension between the Israelites and the Moabites was not one of just mutual trade and cultural exchange. Rather, it goes back pretty far, and it's actually had really a lot of tension between the two nations. So we can begin to learn about this tension when we see where Moab came from. Now, you're probably thinking that you know where the Moabites come from, but if we look at Genesis chapter 19, you can turn there. Genesis chapter 19 and verses 36 to 37. So here we have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah with Lot. And Lot is the nephew of Abraham. So both Abraham and Lot left their land to the east and traveled west. And Lot established himself in this area where Sodom and Gomorrah were the cities. And if you look at a map, because Moab is right next to the Dead Sea, the proposed places for where Sodom and Gomorrah used to be are right basically in the land of Moab, but no longer in the land of Moab because of the destruction of the cities. So this is right in the area where Moab was supposed to be formed. But what happened when Lot and his wife and his two daughters left the Sodom and Gomorrah, as you probably know, Lot's wife turned around, looked at the cities, and was turned to salt. And then the daughters of Lot were wondering how they're going to have any offspring. So they both got their father drunk, and through that were able to produce sons. And so in verse 36, it says, "Thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. The younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites to this day." So when you're reading through the Old Testament, you often hear a bunch of these different tribes. You have, you know, Edom, you have the Canaanites, you have the Amalekites, and so on and so on. But you have these two that stand out, in addition to the Edomites, but the Moabites and the Ammonites. And the reason they stand out is because they have a closer relation to the children of Israel. They're related through Abraham's nephew, Lot, and his offspring. And so Moab was the name of Lot's firstborn son, and Ben-Ammi, which produced the Ammonites, was the name of Lot's secondborn son, at least in this case. So we see here that Moab traces its roots back to the same family that the Israelites traced their roots back. And nevertheless, there was tension between them. So you might say, okay, well, what happened after this? You know, they're related. Shouldn't that mean that the Moabites and the Israelites should become friends? Isn't that a reason for them to get along? the fact that they both come from the same family ultimately. But if you go to Numbers 22, we see the story of Balaam. So number 22, and we'll just read verses 1 to 6. So this is the case where the Israelites have left Egypt. They've spent pretty much 40 years in the wilderness. They're now almost on the verge of entering the promised land. They've killed Og, the king of Bashan, and Arad as well, and King Sion. And so now we're at the point where they're about to enter the promised land. But as I was saying, Moab is immediately west or immediately east of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. So the Israelites were probably going to go through Moab, and they became scared. So it says here that the king of Moab decided to hire a prophet and who would then curse the Israelites so that they wouldn't be as powerful. So it says, we'll just read verses 1 to 6, "Then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was in great dread of the people because they were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, 'This horde will now lick up all that is around us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field.' So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pithor, which is near the river of the, in the land of the people of Emau, to call him, saying, 'Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they are dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed.'" So they hired Balaam, who was sort of a prophet in the area, and said, "Come and curse the Israelites." Now, we don't have recorded distinct curses that Balaam leveled against the Israelites. In fact, we only have recorded here blessings, but Balaam was not exactly faithful to God in the way that he operated. In fact, he often compromised and said, "Okay, I'm going to give in to what Balak, the king of Moab, is going to do." So even though Balaam, we don't have recorded any specific curses that he said against Israel, but only blessings, he still cooperated with the Moabites. And the Moabites had fundamentally this bad intention directed towards the Israelites. This intention of, "We want to curse you so that you cannot prosper, so that you cannot take over our land." So here is sort of a beginning of this tension between the two groups. Then again, in Judges 3, you don't have to turn here, but in Judges 3, so it says Ruth takes place during the time of Judges. Now, because the genealogy, there's only a couple people until David, it's likely it was nearer towards the end of the Judges, the period of the Judges. But near the beginning of the period of the Judges, there was this one case where the Moabites actually had invaded the land of Israel and had oppressed them for many years. And so in Judges 3, verses 12 to 14, it says, "The people of Israel did again what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the city of the palms. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. Now finally, God raised up the judge Ehud, who was then able to lead the Israelites to defeat the Moabites. And it says they killed 10,000 Moabites, and Moab was subdued, it says, that day under the hand of Israel. But nevertheless, we have these two situations in which Moab and Israel were at odds. The first case with Balaam, the second case with Eglon. Now, as a result of Balaam and the attempt of Balak to get him to curse the Israelites, in Deuteronomy, they made some special sanctions that were specifically directed towards the Moabites and the Ammonites. So it says in Deuteronomy 23, and you don't have to turn here, "No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you." So that's in Deuteronomy 23. So here Moses is, you know, giving instructions to the Israelites right before they enter the promised land. And among these instructions it says, you know, people can join the Israelites so long as they make themselves one of you. You know, they get circumcised, they decide to follow your God, and so on, if they are strangers from distant lands. But if they are Ammonites or Moabites, an exception applies. And it means that they cannot come into the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. And this is sort of a curse or a prohibition based on the fact that instead of meeting the Israelites with bread and water when they were wandering through the wilderness and about to enter the promised land, instead they hired Balaam to curse them. Now, in a similar kind of law directed towards the Moabites, also in Deuteronomy, Moses says, "Do not harass Moab or contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession." So we have all these kind of conflicting messages here. On the one hand, the Moabites, along with the Ammonites, were related to the Israelites through Lot and Abraham. But on the other hand, historically, the Moabites had not been friendly to the Israelites, and so there was this tension. So on the one hand, the Israelites were not allowed to conquer the land of Moab because of their relationship. But on the other hand, the Moabites were not allowed to enter the assembly of the Lord because of their history of hostility. So this is kind of the background of the book of Ruth. So the idea of Naomi and her family traveling to Moab in order to flee a famine, it's not parallel to, you know, an American traveling to Canada or somewhere in order to flee a famine or something, or a Canadian traveling to America to flee a famine. It's not that kind of parallel. Rather, there's a history of animosity and tension between the two nations, which makes it all the more apparent that a Moabite would struggle to fit in Israel, just as an Israelite would struggle to fit in Moab. Now, another element in the book of Ruth, I think that's important to point out here, is the role of a redeemer. Right? So there's this kind of confusing bit in the fourth chapter and the third chapter where it mentions Boaz as this redeemer. And you think, okay, what's it mean to be a redeemer? Now, immediately, you know, living after the life and death of Christ and knowing about the New Testament, we probably immediately think, oh, Christ is our redeemer, right? So it must have some sort of connection here. But it goes back as well to the law and the Jewish law, the idea of a redeemer. So there are actually two elements involved in Boaz being what they call a redeemer. On the one hand, and this is a law specific to the Israelites, a law that we don't have, you know, in America, really. I don't know of it being anywhere practiced really right now. There are two elements of being a redeemer. On the one hand, a redeemer is the one who's able to buy back land that his brother sold during, say, a famine. So Boaz is able to buy back. So he has the authority, through his relationship with Elimelech, to buy back the land that may have been lost when Naomi and the family left to go to Moab. So this is described in Leviticus 25. You don't have to turn there. But it says, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land." This is kind of a complicated law that is described in Leviticus. It's a law of basically every 50 years, there would be a jubilee year. And so everyone initially, each family, was allotted a certain section of land in the land of Israel. And you could buy and sell different land and so on. But every 50 years, it had to go back to the family that originally had it. Right? So you could imagine right here in Wisconsin, right? You have, let's say, you know, 200 years ago, they split up Wisconsin into a bunch of counties. And say 100 counties. And so 100 families owned all of Wisconsin, let's say. Now, every 50 years, they could sell and buy land from another. So if one person owned a part of land that wasn't very productive and they needed to make money, they maybe could sell it to someone else, right? And then get that money and start up a business, let's say. So basically, in the 50 years, you could buy and sell land. But after the 50 years ended, the land had to be returned to the family to which it was initially granted. So every 50 years, all of those lands go back to the original families that it was allotted to. So you can see that this makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for an outsider to come in and buy up land, right? Because it's already guaranteed to the, say, 100 families or so that it's allotted to. But on the other hand, it means that it's very difficult for monopolies to develop, right? So if one person is especially clever in business and is able to buy up all the land in Wisconsin, that person cannot keep that land forever in their family. So every 50 years, it has to go back to its original owners. That's more or less what was going on in Israel. Every 50 years, the land had to go back to its original owner. And so each family had an allotted piece of land. Now, if it was a long time until the Jubilee, let's say it was still 30 years to the Jubilee and you wanted to have your land back, there were two other options. One was to get a relative to buy the land back for you. So let's say you're one of these families in Wisconsin and you're related to another family and you're really poor. Well, you could get that other family, that relative, to then buy back that land for you from whoever you sold it to. Or the other option is if in the course of time you become wealthy enough, you can buy back your own land. So it was called a sort of redemption or redeeming. And the reasoning behind this, it says in Leviticus 25, the reasoning behind this is because ultimately all land belongs to God. So as we recognize, everything belongs to God originally because God is the ultimate creator of everything. And so to say that one piece of property belongs to someone forever is then to forget that God actually owns it ultimately. So that was the reasoning behind these laws, as it says in Leviticus 25. It says, "For this land is mine, you are strangers and sojourners with me." Now the other way that Boaz can be a redeemer, so he can be a redeemer by buying back the land for the sake of his brother, Elimelech. The other way you can be a redeemer is if you had if a woman was married to a man and the man dies, then that man's next of kin is then obligated to marry the woman and produce offspring in the name of the man who died. So sorry, this is really complicated, right? But trust me, like if you it can be figured out even though it is complicated. So I'll read a passage in Deuteronomy. This is described. This is other aspect of redemption. It says, "If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel." So again, we return to this idea of families continuing on in perpetuity. So if a man dies without any heir, his wife then should produce an heir who can then inherit that man's property. So in a sense, it's a service that the brother will have to perform for the sake of his brother and the brother's ability to continue his line, being able to continue to own parts of the land. So basically, Boaz, in being a redeemer, was serving the function of not only buying back the land that was probably lost by Elimelech and Naomi when they left Israel, or at some point, but also he was a redeemer in the sense that by marrying Ruth, he was then able to produce offspring for Ruth's husband and in turn Naomi. So that's why it says at the very end of Ruth that now Naomi ineffectively has a son. Even though Naomi was not blood relatives to Ruth, still the fact that Boaz and Ruth were able to bear a son means now that Naomi's family will continue on. So that was really important for them. And a lot of these customs don't make a lot of sense for us today, but it's still really important to understand them in order to understand sort of the context of the story. So these two roles then of being a redeemer. And it was probably especially, so as you read in Ruth, there was another person who could have been a redeemer, but he declined. He said, "No, I don't want to take on the responsibility of being with Ruth." And so then Boaz was able to take responsibility and be the redeemer. So this would have been especially problematic, the fact that Ruth was a Moabite, right? Because knowing the status of the Moabites in Israel, you'd think, well, why would you ever want to continue the offspring that would be coming from a Moabite woman? You should just continue your own offspring. It was the fault of your nephew to even marry a Moabite in the first place, therefore they should suffer for it, and I'm not going to do any good service for that. So there would have been that tension there operative, and that's why, you know, a lot of this, it was so surprising that Boaz would have taken Ruth and had a child with her. So in this story, we can see that there are three different types of sojourning. There's the sojourning of Naomi, Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon, so Naomi and her husband, as well as her two sons. They were sojourning as immigrants into the land of Moab. Now you might say, maybe they're even refugees, you could say, because they were fleeing a famine. It doesn't seem clear that the famine was severe enough for everyone to leave, but it was severe enough for some people to consider living in a hostile land to be better than living in their homeland. So this is kind of a sojourning out of necessity. So they left the land of Israel because it just was not fulfilling their needs and desires. And they had to go to a foreign land where they would never feel welcome in order to continue existing. And they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem and Judah, same clan, city, and tribe of David and Jesus. And their situation was similar to that of Jacob and Joseph and the 11 brothers who traveled to Egypt to escape the ongoing famine in the Middle East. We see other examples of this kind of sojourning in order to flee bad times or hard times. I mean, in America, we really haven't, and in Canada, we really haven't had hard times, at least in the recent past, that we've had to, you know, travel other places for. But no doubt in the Great Depression, people were traveling west to find work and so on, largely for similar reasons. The fact is, driven out of necessity to go and find a place where you can dwell. But it's not necessarily your home. There's another way in which there's a story of sojourners in the book of Ruth. And it's a story of Ruth. So while Naomi and her family left Israel to go to Moab because of necessity, Ruth came back to Israel not out of necessity. She could have maybe had a better life still in Moab with her sister-in-law, maybe remarried and so on. But instead, she went back to Israel out of love. So there's this sense of sojourning or being an immigrant, and is out of love. So Naomi and her family left out of necessity, out of need. Ruth left her homeland out of love for Naomi. Remember the part where she says, you know, your God will be my God, I will die, you know, with you, and so on and so forth. So this is kind of an immigration from love, and many people, we see even today, will leave their homelands out of love to settle in a foreign land that isn't initially their home. Now the final kind of sojourning here that we see in this book is that of the sojourning that justifies the redemption of the property. So as you saw when I was reading in Leviticus, the reasoning for this kind of inheritance operation, the fact that the land would go back to the original owners every 50 years, was justified in terms of the fact that God ultimately owns everything. So it was to symbolize God's ultimate ownership, and that we are just using things that God created. We're just here for a time, and it's God's gift that we're able to have anything at all. So that's, I think, a third sense of sojourning. The fact is that both the Moabites and the Israelites and everyone else who's lived on the earth, including us today, we only live here in virtue of God's grace and generosity and his gift, right? Because clearly none of us made ourselves, none of us have made the world in which we were born, and so everything that we have ultimately comes from somewhere other than ourselves, which ultimately traces back to God. So everything we have is a gift, and in that sense, we are not creators of what we have, and so in that sense, we're sojourners. Now, we can apply this then to the Christian life of sojourning that I mentioned earlier. And one of the most famous passages for sojourning in the Christian life comes in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 to 12. So it says here, Peter says, but you are, he's talking to the Christians, Christians who are being persecuted and so on, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellences of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." So here, Peter is talking about Christians as being sojourners, people who aren't at home in this world. And so this is a theme that I think we can find throughout the New Testament. The idea, so as I talked about last time I was preaching, the idea that the disciples were expecting a physical kingdom. They were expecting Jesus to become king of Israel, to have physical wars, and so on. And what they didn't realize was that Jesus was actually establishing a spiritual kingdom, and one that would transcend all physical boundaries, all physical nations, all physical peoples, and so on. One that would reach out beyond the Jews to the Gentiles and initially be spiritual, and later on, I believe, become physical in the millennium. And now, in a similar way, Peter's writing about the sojourners as a Christian. So and there's a sense in which we have to remember that this is not our home. And for us in the West, I know for myself, it's sometimes very, very easy to think that, wow, we have it so good, this must be our home, right? You know, we have freedom of religion and freedom of speech, and we have, you know, we can go and do things. We don't have to meet in private, right? We're not in anyone's home. We don't have to hide when we're coming to any churches. So there's a sense in which you know, we could say, you know, we are at home in this world. We have, you know, all these luxuries. But Peter warns us, like, not to be too content here. And it's a good thing. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. It's a really good thing that we have the freedom and to be openly Christians, that we don't have to hide it, that we don't have to run around, you know, in homes in secret. It's a wonderful thing. But sometimes we can forget as a result that our ultimate place is with Christ and our ultimate goal is with Him. And that we aren't yet finish struggling against the spiritual forces. Now, this message is a lot more clear to people who are undergoing persecution, right? So I was reading this one book lately. I was going to bring it, but I couldn't find it. But it was called Fleeing ISIS, Finding Jesus. So it's about this journalist guy who read an article saying, you know, is Christianity dead in the Middle East, right? And he's like, you know, he's wondering. He's like, well, is it? Right? And he's heard stories and whatnot, but of course, you can't hear a lot of these stories up front because the people are being persecuted, and so it's dangerous for them to become vocal about their persecution and even their faith. So he went to the Middle East, and he was interviewing some people, and he was in Jordan, and he heard about this one man who was a jeweler. He was a jeweler in Iraq for many years, many generations, and he was a Christian. And then when ISIS came, they forced him to leave, and so he put so he had all kinds of gold that he'd inherited for generations and generations, right? All kinds of gold, so extremely wealthy. And he realized he had to leave, so he packed as much gold as he could into his car and said, okay, I'm going to have to take off and maybe go to Jordan or something. And he was in his car, and he was stopped somewhere at a patrol by ISIS, and they said, look, you're lucky to have your life. So they got him out of the car and told him to run away, and then they took all the gold that was in his car and so on. Other families were talking about how when they left their homes in Iraq, they would let their neighbors look after them, right? So, you know, you have neighbors next to you, and you know, you get to know them, have barbecues or whatnot. You say, well, look, we're going to be gone for a couple years, maybe. Can you just look after our house when we're gone? And so one of the things that happened, they saw on Facebook, was that their friends, their neighbors, who they entrusted their property to, were actually starting to wear their clothes, starting to use their house, and things like that. And so they weren't actually keeping their promises, but instead they were taking their possessions for themselves. So for people who've undergone, you know, situations like this, the story of Christians being pilgrims and sojourners is so much more tangible than it is, I think, for people like us who've never had to really experience this loss and so on. But nevertheless, I think we should continue to remember that we are always not in this world, that this fundamentally isn't our place, and that ultimately we're fighting against the forces that would try to get us to think that this is our home. Now, in one place, for example, it says in John, actually 1 John chapter 2 and verses 15 to 16, John again makes this really clear when he says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and the pride and possessions, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away with its desire." So here John emphasizes the very theme that Peter brings out, the idea that, you know, we can have possessions, and there's nothing wrong with, you know, owning things, right? And there's nothing wrong with education or taking part in things that go on, right? In fact, it's a false dichotomy to say either we live in the world and do those things, or we have to, you know, live in a commune somewhere all segregated from the rest of society, right? That's not what John's saying. Rather, what he's saying is, you know, don't cling too closely to our possessions. Don't cling too closely to the success we have in life, because ultimately that's not where our identity and where our life lies. Rather, it lies in Christ and the life that he will provide us in the future. And so, and then another thing that occurs is that often we think that, well, because we're safe, then everything should be fine. But then the other argument is that, well, okay, if we aren't part of the world, then we should establish our own kind of huddled kind of community, right? And we see that this happens with some groups of people, right? They'll go out into maybe Wyoming, right? They say, okay, well, let's start a city here that it's only for Christians, right? Only Christians can live here, and it's going to be the new kind of God's kingdom here on earth. We know that's not the right response either, because that's just saying that, well, this world is our home, we just need to make it more accommodating for us. And there are other problems with that kind of mentality of saying, well, let's all go out to Wyoming and establish our own community, because we know that just because parents are Christians does not mean that your children will automatically become Christians. And so there's a sense in which Christianity, unlike other religions, is not inherited by blood, but rather through faith. And so the response to saying the world is not my home, to then, you know, isolate ourselves, that's not the right response either. Rather, the right response is to have a renewed mind and our desires to be changed, so that while we do the same things as people who are not Christians do, like we go to work, we make money, we have families, you know, we drive cars and listen to music and whatnot, although we do all those same things, we do it with a different attitude. We don't do it with an attitude of, I need to get as much as I can, much pleasure as I can out of this life, or I need to do this so that I can augment my own reputation. We don't do it with that attitude. Rather, we do it with an attitude of, look, everything I do should be done knowing that God is watching, knowing that I need to be faithful to God. So the response to saying that the Christian is not of this world is not to retreat into a sort of isolated community, nor is it to become extremely legalistic and, you know, taste not, touch not, and so on. Rather, it's to adopt a new mind where the way we act in the world is one that's always has Christ in mind, rather than having our own immediate gratification, our own honor, and our own success in mind, right? So that's the way I think we should interpret this not being part of a world. And it's a way that applies not just to the persecuted church, the church where, you know, at any instant you might be imprisoned, but also to the church in the West, where we're almost certainly not going to be imprisoned for our beliefs. And so both churches, both kinds of churches, can still adopt the same mind, where whatever we do, we're doing it for the glory of God, not for our own instant gratification, not to manipulate people, and not to get the best out of every situation. So that's kind of what I see in Ruth, kind of an example or a story illustrating this principle of being a pilgrim that we can think about on this Mother's Day. So I'm just going to close in a word of prayer. Dear Lord, we just thank you for this freedom we have to worship here and to learn about your word. I just pray that we'll keep in mind that everything we do, insofar as we belong to you, everything we do should be done for your glory and for your sake, Lord, and to remember that we are pilgrims in this world. I just pray that you bless the activities, the remainder of the day, and trips and whatnot. In Jesus' name, amen.